The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Good evening, listeners. I'm Eric Peabody, and this is the Horror Hill Podcast. Tonight, we have another trio of stories for you, starting with a couple of quick scares to whet your appetite before we dive into the big one. First, P.D. Williams has been kind enough to supply us with two stories, Magic 8-Ball and Who Is This? We can read through them in almost the same time it would take to summarize them, so let's not spoil anything, eh? Then, we have the evening's main event, The Temple in the Lake by Christian Wallace. In this story, we follow Stephen, an engineer working in Antarctica, Strike 1, on a secretive government project, Strike 2, where something unexpected has been discovered underneath the ice, Strike 3. I mean, what could possibly go wrong here? You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author P.D. Williams, I give you Magic 8-Ball. Stephen guzzled 4 beers, giving him a wicked buzz, but compared to his buddies, he was a lightweight. He had reached the age of 25, a significant age by common standards. Thus, it was time to party. It thrilled him to have his best friends, Tyler and Evan, to share it with, bombed though they were.
"Jeez, dude," Evan said to Tyler. "You're really throwing back the highballs. You might want to drink some water with him."
"I am, see? The ice in my glass is melting."
"Quit harassing the man," Stephen said to Evan. "I wouldn't be sitting here if it weren't for him. I'd be sitting over there with that hot babe in the Daisy Dukes and the tight Foo Fighters t-shirt." Tyler sized up the girl in question.
"That tea must be 100% cotton, 'cause that thing has shrunk."
"You know, stupid," Evan said. "Isn't there something else you're supposed to be doing? Give you a hint. It rhymes with birthday present."
"Oh, nearly forgot,"
Tyler said. He fumbled beneath his seat and produced a small, haphazardly wrapped box and set it on the table in front of Stephen.
"Okay, Stevie baby, we know how much you love to collect vintage toys and stuff, so we did a little research and found something special you said you'd love to get your hands on. And no, I don't mean Evan's mom."
"Hey," Evan shouted, "lay off my mom. She's the reason I've become the respectable drunk that I am today."
Then, lifting his glass, said,
"Cheers, Ma."
Tyler sneered at Evan's inebriated outburst.
"I apologize to you, Evan. How rude of me to speak while you were trying to interrupt. Where was I? Oh yeah, the present. We got it from the private collection of some weird rich snob out of Ireland. I know it's only the one gift, but it cost us a pretty penny, so you better like it.
Steven said, only one way to find out. Here we go.
Wait, Tyler shouted. Let's add some measure of decorum here and give a proper intro. On the count of two.
Why two? Steven asked.
Because if we start at three, I don't know if I'll still be conscious by the time we hit one.
I see your point. Please, continue.
I surely will. On the count of two, we shout loud enough to generate concern amongst the other patrons in this establishment.
Shh, keep it down, stupid, warned Evan.
All right, Tyler said, pressing his index finger to his lips in a shushing gesture. Okay, he's ready? Here we go.
Steven's intoxicated brethren counted down in unison.
Two, one, surprise!
Steven ripped through the paper and raised the item to his face. He marveled at the genuine and well-maintained 1950s Magic 8 Ball, sealed inside its original box.
Are you serious? Is this a real deal? Steven asked.
Evan chimed in to reassure him. Does a bear crap what's left of you in the woods?
Hell yeah!
Whoa, dudes, Steven said. There can't be more than a few original 8 Balls in this condition. Should I open it? It might kill the value. I can't decide.
Nah, go ahead, rip in, enjoy it, Evan replied.
Steven restrained himself from being impulsive and tearing into it like a pit bull on a pork chop.
If it's okay with you guys, I think I'll wait and decide later. Wow, you two are the best.
We know,
they screamed as they generated concern amongst the other patrons in the establishment. Another beer and an Uber ride later, Steven was back in his apartment. He was still deciding if he should open the box. Like I'm ever gonna get rid of this sucker. Besides, I want to be its first customer. Steven plopped onto the couch like a bomb from a warplane, almost flattening his sleepy cat, Melvin. He opened the box's lid and removed the prized collectible. He was filled with joy as he gazed upon the object of his pleasure. He asked a simple yes or no question. Will I ever be rich? He shook the 8-ball, flipped it over, and waited for the pre-written, random answer to bob to the surface of the dark blue water. He was neither delighted nor discouraged by the response.
No.
Okie dokie, Mr. Magic 8-ball. Will I ever meet Miss Wright?
He shook the ball and turned to the bottom to read the meaningless answer.
Definitely not.
Dang, dude, Steven chuckled. That's just mean. Being drunk and in a silly mood, he continued.
Okay, all-knowing 8-ball, let's try a harder one. What's my cat's name?
The response took Steven aback.
Melvin.
After a brief silence, Steven squinted his eyes and asked again. He shook the ball for a few seconds and then held it in his hands to prepare himself. When he was ready, he turned the toy over and read its reply.
Melvin.
Steven jumped from the sofa, causing the 8-ball to fall and roll beneath the coffee table. The unexpected commotion caused Melvin to shriek and sprint towards the bedroom. Steven paced back and forth, rubbing his hands together.
Oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh.
Once Steven pulled himself together, he appealed to the small part of his brain that wasn't drenched in alcohol. It occurred to him that his so-called buddies might have rigged the toy to produce the unexpected answers. He could envision them parked nearby, roaring with drunken laughter. However, despite his best reasoning, he couldn't figure out how it could be possible for them to pull off something so complicated. How could they anticipate what questions he would ask? And if they could, how could they hear him outside of a hidden microphone in his apartment? He figured the theory was too fanciful to be true.
Steven took in a few deep breaths like he was going to bungee jump. Then he fished the magic 8-ball from under the table.
He clutched the globe and perched himself on the sofa's edge, pondering his next question. It was based on something nobody knew.
All right, magic 8-ball. What magazine did I keep hidden under my mattress when I was in junior high?
Jugs aplenty.
Steven's body felt as if it were closing in on itself as he read the ball's spot-on answer. His hands were shaking,
making it difficult to grip the oversized billiard ball. His heartbeat thumped in his ears as he cupped his hands to his mouth and hyperventilated into his palms. He wanted to throw the toy out the window to the parking lot below, yet he hesitated. What if? He wondered. Stephen started thinking about how accurate the answers to his personal questions were and the positive outcomes they could bring. Interest replaced his fears as he looked into the amazing possibilities for his future. Which stock should I buy? What lottery number should I play? What's the pin of a rich person? He breezed through all the questions, but kept receiving the same reply. Ask another question. Upon realizing that the object would not grant his selfish desires, Stephen retreated to fare more pedestrian. Will I get a raise soon? No. That's cool, I can deal with that. Let's get to a good one. Will I die soon? Yes. Stephen's mouth went dry. He hesitated before asking the next question. Although he dreaded the response, he pushed himself to ask, when? Tomorrow. Stephen's pulse rate sped up as he stared at the frightening response. His breath quaking with nerves, he posed the next logical question. What's gonna happen to me? Explosion. Explosion? Where? Stephen gripped the ball and shook it as if he were trying to strangle an attacker. Then he turned the toy over. Work. Oh God, are you telling me my building's gonna blow up? It is so. Stephen pressed forward with the next question. Will any of my co-workers die with me? Yes, definitely. Oh no, how many? Everyone. That can't be right. For the love of mercy, Becky has a kid on the way. Stephen rubbed his right temple as if pushing the awful information into his brain might help him better understand the magnitude of the tragic event. All right, just tell me this. Will this huge explosion cause any collateral damage? It is certain. How many more dead? Everyone. Stephen sat upright on the sofa, every nerve and muscle in his body strained with tension. He looked down at the toy. You're saying there's going to be a deadly explosion tomorrow and it'll be powerful enough to kill everyone in and around my building? Will it be a terrorist bombing? A gas leak? No. Then what? Tell me, specifically, what's going to explode? He was about to shake the magic eight ball, but before he did so, the tiny triangle bobbed to the inky surface on its own and displayed the terrifying truth. Earth. You've been listening to Magic 8 Ball by P.D. Williams. Next, also from P.D. Williams, I present, Who is this? Who is this? Asked the disgruntled voice on the other end of the line. What? That was the only response Larson had to the unexpected question. He thought he had dialed the right number to his supervisor's office. My God, he'd dialed it 100 times. But this time, he hadn't. Your name. Give me your name. The man insisted. Larson wondered if he'd actually dialed the right number and if someone at the hotel was pulling a prank on him. This is Larson, calling for Bill. No, I mean your full name. Larson what? Something about this guy felt very wrong to Larson. His voice was unnerving. He decided it was time to end the call, joke or not. He held the phone close to his face, then spoke directly into it. None of your business, jerk! Then he quickly pressed the end button. Man, that was creepy, he thought. Larson had no desire to contact his supervisor after that. He only wanted to get his work schedule for next week, but he could do that later. Besides, his toddler, Jake, would wake up from his nap soon. He slept for 2 hours every afternoon. You could practically set your watch by him. Larson worked nights at the Ramada Inn, while Caitlin, his wife, worked days down at the bank. They rarely saw each other. But whatever time they squeezed in over the weekends, if Larson didn't have to work, always seemed to make up for the week's separation. However, This weekend, she was at her sister's place, helping her paint a bathroom while Larson watched the little guy. Jake was nearly 2 years old. It wouldn't be long before he reached an age where Larson and Caitlin felt comfortable enrolling him in daycare. Then maybe Larson could get back to the first shift at the hotel. In the meantime, he was treasuring every moment with his first and only child.
Ring, ring. Better get that, Larson thought. If Jake doesn't wake up of his own prerogative, he is one ornery little hombre.
He guessed it was Caitlin making one of her, "You didn't lose our child, did you?" midday checkup calls. "Hello?" he said.
"Hello, Larson. Tell me something. What did you do with all the money your mother gave you for charm school?" It was the same man he'd hung up on earlier.
A mixture of shame and fear overwhelmed Larson, like someone had caught him doing something terrible.
"How'd you get this number?" "Ever hear of caller ID, jerk?"
"Oh, bother," thought Larson. He found it odd that he would think of those two words at a time like this. The comments came from one of Jake's Winnie the Pooh books. Pooh always said it when he found himself in trouble.
"Larson, we've got to stop meeting like this," the man said casually.
Larson broke off the call. His concern was not only for himself, he had a family to worry about as well. He sat down and began thinking of a reasonable way to manage the crank caller without making things worse. After all, this whack job had his number now. Larson was drifting toward the living room sofa when the phone rang again. He jerked as if a static shock had stung him. He answered it immediately, saying nothing at first. His nerves were too jangly. Then, as calmly as he could, he said, "Hello?"
"Look, Larson, you're really beginning to annoy me. First you call here and interrupt me while I'm..."
"Listen," Larson explained in his most apologetic tone. "I'm sorry if I interrupted you in the middle of something, okay? I just dialed the wrong number. That happens to the best of us every once in a while."
"Doesn't happen to me," the caller said condescendingly.
"Well, maybe not, but for those of us who aren't perfect..."
"You saying I think I'm perfect? Is that where we're at now, Larson? You psychic all of a sudden? Let's have some fun then. Right now, I'm thinking of a number from, let's say, 1 to 50.
No, let's make it 1 to 10. Tell me, Larson, what number am I thinking of?" Larson's fear of the city's headcases was swiftly being replaced with hostility toward the arrogant loon he was talking to.
"Look, pal, I said I was sorry. Sounds to me like maybe you've got more problems than a few wrong numbers calling. As a matter of fact, here's one more problem for you. I have your number, too."
Larson fibbed a bit on that one, as his phone did not have that feature. "If you call my number one more time, I'll report you to the authorities. Then, when they take your phone away, you won't have to worry about any more annoying calls." He waited for another smug response, but none came. There was only a long silence. Larson figured that he'd better just end things, but the caller hung up first. He wasn't sure how to feel about how the verbal exchange had gone. These days, you never knew who you were dealing with.
"How's that for city living?" he mused.
After a few minutes of sitting and no phone calls, Larson calmed down. He was just getting ready to reach for the TV's remote control when his phone rang again. Although it wasn't as startling as before, it was still enough to put him back on edge. He picked up the phone and, in a formidable tone, asked, "Yes?"
"Yes,"
Caitlin said on the other line. "Who are you supposed to be, the butler?" Relieved, Larson smiled despite himself.
"Oh, hi, honey. I just thought it was someone else."
"Is Jake still sleeping? I didn't wake him, did I? Is that why you sounded so miffed? Did you think I was one of those telephone solicitors?"
"No, it's just that I had a freaky experience today."
Concerned, Caitlin asked, "What happened?" Larson paused. Should he worry Caitlin unnecessarily over something that could be as trivial as some hothead he'd awakened from a nap? He decided he'd just leave it to lie and swiftly offered an innocuous explanation.
"Oh, you know how weird some of those wrong numbers can be."
"Yeah, I suppose. I was only calling to check up on you two. Everything A-okay?"
"We're just fine, hun. Now get back to work, woman,"
Love you, she whispered seductively. Love you too, he cooed. Bye, sweets.
Trying to be amusing and annoying, Larson said in a love-struck voice, You hang up first.
No, you hang up first.
No, you ha-
Caitlin put a stop to the nonsense by hanging up first. Larson's mood lifted. He went to make sure Big Jake was still alive, like a lot of first-time parents do. He was relieved to find him blissfully asleep, his Donald Duck pacifier bobbing gently in his mouth. Larson decided he could use some lunch, so he headed down the hall to the kitchen. The next 15 minutes passed without incident. Then the phone rang again. Larson was willing to bet the ranch and the double wide next to it that Caitlin was calling back to tease him some more. He would have lost that bet.
Hello? Larson said, his tone more relaxed.
Hi, Larson. It's me again. Listen, Larson, it's not as hard as you might think to get someone's address once you have their phone number, so you should really be careful how you talk to people.
Larson's anger rose.
Listen, idiot, I've had about enough of this crap. You show up on my doorstep and I'll make you wish your old man had used better protection.
Oh, now, Larson, the man said in a conciliatory tone. It's bad enough when you...
Hey, I've said all I'm gonna say to you, scumbag. You think you're so tough? Quit calling me like a frightened little preschooler and come on over. I'll kick your smarmy...
Larson's tirade ended with a soft click when the stranger hung up. Slowly, his anger turned to pride as he realized he had likely put an end to the malcontent. Still, he was a little ashamed that he'd allowed himself to be brought down to the level of such a petulant dweeb. A short time later, Jake awoke from his afternoon nap. Larson lifted him from his crib and held him tightly in his arms as Jake slowly eased back into the brave new world around him.
You'd have been pretty proud of your old man today, bragged Larson. Nobody messes with us, do they, buddy?
As if to better prove this point, the rest of the afternoon passed with no additional calls from the stranger. Caitlin got home a little earlier than expected, which was a good thing. She, Larson, and the baby could spend some much-needed and well-deserved time together before he had to start the night shift at the hotel. They enjoyed some leftover lasagna as they caught up on the day's events. Once they were done, Caitlin and Larson settled down on the sofa and switched on the television. From time to time, they watched the apple of their eye exploring the vast frontier, otherwise known as the living room. Larson had a satisfied look on his face that belied the mano-a-mano victory he had won earlier in the day.
What's that for? Caitlin asked with a curious smile.
What's what for? Larson answered with faux innocence.
That mischievous grin that makes you look like a Cheshire cat.
Oh, nothing.
Just can the phony modesty. What did you do?
It's really nothing, Larson replied, his ever-broadening smile betraying him.
Larson,
Caitlin whined.
Tell me or else.
Or else what? He asked teasingly.
Caitlin leaned over to give him a playful slap on the face, but before she could, he relented.
All right, he laughed. I'll tell you. Remember earlier when you called and I told you that...
Shh, Caitlin said. There's a news bulletin on.
Larson grabbed the remote and turned up the sound. The police arrested the serial killer known as the Torch a short time ago, just outside this apartment building, said the reporter.
Caitlin's mouth fell open and she yanked in a frightened breath. Dear God, Larson, that's our building.
She upped the volume. It began when an individual who was walking her dog noticed a suspicious-looking man jogging east on Tyler Avenue, the reporter said. According to her account, he was carrying a small canvas bag and a 2-gallon gas can. She added that he appeared angry and was talking to himself loudly. Thinking it odd, she called 911 to report the incident. When officers responded, the suspect began running. The officers caught him and, after a violent struggle, placed him under arrest.
Larson felt cold, immobile.
The reporter continued as police officers ushered a growing group of onlookers behind a cordon of yellow tape. The suspect, whom authorities have ID'd as Reuben Norse, was holding a family of four captive 6 blocks west of here. Eventually, the father, who asked not to be identified,
was able to break free of his restraints and call for help. He described how Norse tied them up and gagged them before pouring gasoline on and around them. Norse then removed a lighter from his pocket, but before he could set the apartment ablaze, he received a phone call. The father observed Norse was extremely agitated while speaking with the caller. After a few more exchanges, Norse grabbed his canvas bag and the container of gasoline and stormed out of the apartment. Police are trying to ascertain where he was going and why.
"Jeez, what a world," Caitlin muttered. "Thank God they finally caught that animal. Terrifies me to think he was right outside our building. Anyhow, what was it you were going to tell me? Larson? Larson?"
You've just heard Who Is This? By P.D. Williams. P.D. Williams is an author, multi-instrumentalist, and composer. Several of the most popular and well-known horror podcasts, both domestically and internationally, have showcased his short horror fiction stories. His macabre tales have also appeared in print form, published by several hardcover anthology series, e-zines, and e-books dedicated to fans of terror and suspense. And now for the main event this evening, The Temple in the Lake by Christian Wallace. "You get clearance?" I asked as Kim approached my workstation. "Some questions about a cousin with a big following on Instagram, but that's about it," she replied. "Not the most normal background check I've been through. I don't really get the big deal, though. They brought me here. Why do I need further clearance just to enter this funny little place?" "It's about containment," I said. "No one thinks you're going to steal equipment or military secrets, although God knows my drones are valuable enough to the right people." I reached out and patted the sleek black hull of the car-sized submersible laid out on the large workbench before me. "They're concerned about more generalized social media leaks. What they have here, well, it's odd to say the least. Has Alex briefed you yet?"
"Yeah, he did," she answered.
"I'm assuming that's..." She nodded towards the enormous pressure chamber that dominated the room. "I didn't really think it was true when Alex told me," she continued. "They're talking about a possible inland sea that was sealed off 100,000 years ago, right? They say the pressure keeps it liquid."
"And that's the official story, but no one knows for sure," I replied. "Unlike Lake Vostok, no one knew this thing was here until they stumbled across it. Alex's team was originally here just doing meteorological work."
"How did they drill a tunnel down to it if they didn't know it was here?" Kim asked as she stepped past me and went to the chamber's bulkhead.
"My guess is they were doing something they shouldn't be," I answered while moving beside her to look through the glass. "You'll probably find the U.S. government's up to all sorts of things down here, and that's why they're keeping it secret. I mean, it's that or what Alex told me is true. And that's just... well, it's not possible."
"What did he say?"
"He told me the hole appeared on its own." I shrugged. The chamber came afterwards to allow access and to stop the water flooding upwards from pressure. She leaned forward and wiped the condensation off the tiny window on the steel door.
"Maybe that's why they don't want us telling anyone about it," Kim replied.
"Maybe they don't know what's down there yet, and they want to know first before celebrating it as the scientific discovery of the century."
Kim stood on her toes to look through the glass and into the water below. Beyond was a small room with a floor covered in churning black water that never seemed to stay still. The movement reminded me of an ocean in miniature with waves that never stopped. Sometimes, if I stared too long, I felt a kind of vertigo from the warped perspective, like I was looking down on some colossal ancient ocean from hundreds of feet in the air. I couldn't help but wonder what made the water move like that. I figured that it must be driven by forces and currents that originated miles beneath the ice, which was a sobering reminder that I was staring at a direct connection to a primordial abyss unlike any other on the planet.
"Gotta wonder what's down there," Kim muttered.
I didn't respond. She might have continued talking, but if she did, it was lost to me. The whole world was reduced to a background hum that barely registered, while the water dominated my view with mesmerizing force. The currents had changed, I couldn't say for sure, but for the briefest of moments, it had looked as if the water had been disturbed by something below. I could have sworn I saw something slithering just beneath the waves. I shook my head and dismissed the thought. "Come on," I told her. "We've got work to do." "What's that?" Alex reached out to the seemingly featureless video feed on the 100-inch monitor. For the last 20 minutes, it had shown us nothing but black, fuzzy noise as the drone descended into what had been dubbed Lake Saturn. The room stayed silent with anticipation, despite the dozen or so people crowded around me as I clutched the joystick with white knuckles. "I didn't see anything," I answered. "Probably just noise. If anything gets close, we'll know for sure. The lights on this thing could cut through brick." "What are we expecting to see in this water exactly?" Kim asked. "I'd be shocked if life down there is multicellular. It's been cut off from the outside world for hundreds of thousands of years." A pale, thin tentacle whipped past, both languid and lightning fast, as if its size and speed were somehow mismatched. All at once, everyone lurched away from the screens, reacting like the monster might reach out through the glass and snatch one of us. For a few seconds, we were all dumbfounded, until the tension eased and people let out astonished gasps and nervous chuckles. A few scientists even cried out in celebration, before scurrying away to a smaller desk to agonize over the recorded footage. "Well, now we know," I said, utterly astonished. "Multicellular life." Another tentacle whipped past, and the accelerometers on the drone registered a kinetic shock. Not that we saw or heard anything of it. The drone's camera showed only pixelated darkness. "It's just scoping us out," I said, looking intently at the profile of acceleration on the drone's instruments. The submersible was being nudged a little from side to side, but it was hardly under attack. It might even be described as a light cuddle, considering the size of the drone and the monster doing it. The encounter lasted a few seconds at most before the squid retreated back into the deep as quickly as it had emerged. "Jesus," Kim cried. "The ventral camera and LIDAR instruments measure it at 30 feet long. "World record for a verified specimen was 22 feet, I said. "So that's the first record broken on this mission." Kim and I began to laugh like excited children, and after a few seconds, the others joined in. "I've never been so happy to be so wrong," she grinned. "Life! Honest to God, multicellular life! There must be an ecosystem down there. Predators, prey, some kind of base to it. Bacteria, fungi, maybe even some kind of plant." The sub's descent continued. Occasionally, the sonar would pick up passing shapes in the void, but nothing else came close enough to register visually. It was unnerving, if I'm honest. Even though I was perfectly safe, I couldn't help but imagine myself down there in that impossibly dark water, while unseen shapes glided silently around me, just a few dozen meters away. It took another hour before we were within 30 feet of the bottom, at which point I slowed the sub's descent and, using downward-facing ventral cameras, looked for some sign of the lake bed. What finally resolved on the smaller screen was a complicated array of strange and irregular-looking rocks. There were spiraling ammonites and lifeless shells everywhere, strange bones jutting out of what looked like an endless carpet of bone-white death. "What?" I muttered. "Animals must have been trapped in the water when it froze over," Alex said. "Animal graveyards are common when excavating dried-up lake beds." "This is normal?" I asked. "No," he shook his head. "Not like this. Not so many." "Talk about an understatement," I said, as I began to pilot the drone in an outward spiral. Every camera showed the same thing, an endless plain of jumbled ivory that stretched out in every direction. If there was a floor beneath those bones, we couldn't see it in that location. "So what does the squid eat?" Kim asked. "If everything under the lake died?" As if in answer, our port side camera picked up the sluggish movement of a pale, white starfish. Slowly, it crawled out of the nasal bone of an ancient whale and probed its surroundings. "It's 30 feet wide," I said, as I squinted at the readings on one of the dozen screens. "Do starfish come that big normally?" Most of the biologists were too busy taking notes to answer, which I took to be a no, but Alex was polite enough to tear his eyes from the screen and answer.
"Absolutely not," he said. "It must grow so big from a lack of..."
A fish larger than the drone swept past the screen, and the starfish was gone. I had the fleeting impression of glassy, transparent teeth and an eyeless face worse than anything found in the Challenger Deep. Wrinkled and frowning, it was an aquatic nightmare that left me shaking in my seat.
"What the fuck?" Kim groaned.
"Jesus Christ, that was... not that," she said, tapping me on the shoulder and gesturing to another screen. There's something odd about 100 yards east. We need to take a look." She reached for the controls, and I stopped her. Despite the intense desire to get up and leave, I felt compelled to see this through. I grabbed the joystick and began to navigate on the heading she gave, my attention so fixed on numerical readouts that I let my eyes drift from the main screen.
"Holy shit!"
I looked up, worried I'd made a grievous error and damaged the drone, and what I saw made my body go limp. We were looking at a building, a temple, in fact. I couldn't say for sure it was a place of worship, of course, but there was no other way to describe the grave-looking structure, with its ancient pillars and decorative flourishes reminiscent of ancient Greece. Perplexed, I let go of the controls and sat back, head tilted like a confused dog. In the end, I settled for what seemed like the only logical explanation. "Is this a prank?" Some of the other scientists with me actually agreed, Kim and several biologists all nodding while turning to look at Alex, the head of the facility. But the look on his face made it clear that if this was a hoax, he wasn't in on it. He was pale, eyes wide, every bit as shocked as we were.
"Why would we do that?" he asked us. "How would we even manage it?"
"Those steps are 30 feet tall," someone cried, before I could push the point any further. I looked away from the screen to see a geologist standing by one of the dozens of smaller screens filled with complex readings. "Can you get me closer?" he asked me. I took a look at the drone camera and approached the first of 20 steps ascending from the lake bed and towards the temple. Pretty quickly, I was able to confirm that each step was a gargantuan slab of stone that towered above the drone.
"This is real?"
I asked Alex as he stepped closer to me, my voice an urgent whisper. He nodded. I looked back at the screen and saw that I was still piloting the drone up and over the steps. At the top, it was apparent just how out of proportion the rest of the temple was. The doorway, a great, big, yawning black portal, must have been several hundred feet tall, and it loomed over the submersible like a man over an ant. Our lights barely penetrated the dark from where we hovered at the threshold, but they did show a stony floor retreating into the void, its surface covered in snowy detritus. In the distance, another tentacle slipped briefly into the light before slithering away. Something about its pallid white features and the sunken dark made my skin crawl, and when I looked up at the crowd, I saw I wasn't the only one whose nerves were frayed. Sweaty, pale faces stared at the screen, unable to look away, but utterly distraught at the implications of what they were seeing. Here was a building at the bottom of the world, standing impossibly tall and impossibly large, its doorway beckoning us to explore further.
"Should I keep going?"
I asked, hoping someone would find a good reason to stop. It didn't matter that it wasn't me down there. I didn't want to push this journey deeper into madness. I was afraid, and no matter how much I reminded myself of the vast distances between me and the source of the images on screen, I could not escape the terrifying fact that the things I was seeing were real. Somewhere beneath my feet lay that abyss, and within it lay a temple beyond all human proportions, and the thought made me feel like my mind was on fire.
"Keep going,"
Kim said. And I knew she was right, too. It was the only choice.
"We need to know."
Nervously, I pushed the drone onwards, watching with anxiety as the side cameras showed the edge of the portal sliding by our sides. As impossible as it was,
I felt as though I was personally stepping into the temple and could feel a cold draft wash over my skin. I shivered and did my best to push the ridiculous idea aside. The room beyond was massive, too large for our meager little lights to see much. After a few seconds of nerve-wracking silence, I finally found my courage and asked, "Do the instruments pick anything out? I feel like I need directions here."
We're getting something a little south of your position. It's stationary, so it should be..."
The entire room cried out as the drone's camera was violently shaken, the view reeling as if the whole drone was being thrown around. Alarms blared from a dozen monitors as every system registered a dozen violations of expected norms. My hands froze up. I was unsure how to proceed. There was a momentary spike of adrenaline as my body reacted as though I'd been personally attacked. And then training took over, and I let go of the controls and waited for a few seconds as a flurry of bubbles and strange shapes flitted past the lens. "The drone can't be damaged easily," I told everyone. "Not by an animal. We just need to be patient." Eventually, the alarms quieted as different team members worked to shut them off. Watching the accelerometer intensely, I could tell that whatever was attacking the drone was slowing down, probably because it realized its prey wasn't edible.
"Looks like another squid,"
someone called, pointing to a dorsal camera that showed a slimy feeler clamped around the hull. For a few more minutes, the drone continued to move of its own accord, being pulled to and fro by some unseen shape. Occasionally, we would catch a glimpse of an overhead ceiling covered in detailed mosaics of a fleshy-looking mountain, or of a beautiful stone pillar cradling an ancient brazier. But there was no opportunity to study these things in detail. They appeared as fleeting blurs of color and shape. Whatever was down there was wrestling with the submersible as if it expected a meal out of it, but I knew it would eventually have to give up.
"Look!"
Whoever cried out didn't need to bother. Whatever had attacked the drone slid around its sleek hull until it faced the forward camera, allowing itself to be seen in full light for the first time. It towered over us from the main display, like it was somehow aware that we were on the other side of the camera. But whatever it was, angry, hostile, or just plain curious, I can't say. It merely stared at us with an eyeless cone for a head. Slowly, the strange creature retreated from the light. That didn't mean it was finished with us, though. One of its longest tendrils remained stuck to the drone, which it used to tow us carefully back towards the entrance of the temple.
"Well, this is exciting," I said after a few minutes had passed. "It's throwing us out of its house."
"You're not seriously proposing that it built that thing, are you?" Kim asked.
"No," I said. "Why build steps if you don't have feet? I think it's just moved in. Probably makes for great shelter."
The creature stopped just as it reached the doorway. All of a sudden, it changed color, flashing from spectral white to a blood orange, pulsating over and over while we all stared at the baffling change in behavior.
"A threat display, perhaps?" Kim asked.
As quickly as it had appeared, the squid shrank away, letting go of the drone right by the temple's doorway. A quick glance at the rear camera showed it fleeing back into the darkness. I was about to ask what had happened when a strange cerulean light flooded the doorway. An eye blocked the doorway, a pupilless, pale blue sphere that glowed with malice in the dark. Slowly, its owner retreated until a monstrous shape glowered down at us. A faint bioluminescence hung around it like an aura, a silhouette faintly visible in the abyss. Its shape was utterly alien. If it hadn't moved, I might have thought I was looking at a plant or a strange rock formation. It reminded me of tumors and wasp nests. I couldn't tell all of its eyes apart from the complicated pattern of dots and frills that covered a bubbling, asymmetrical head the size of an apartment block. It was with ever-rising horror that I realized I had glimpsed simple portrayals of this very creature in the temple mosaics, the implication of which burned in my mind like a hot coal. This thing dwarfed all reason, all sense.
It floated menacingly in the darkness just at the limit of the lights. Of the rest of its body, there was no sign. But I hated it. I hated it instinctively and without reason, even as I told myself it was the scientific find of the century. It made my skin crawl and my stomach drop, and all I wanted to do was lash out and get the hell away from it. Slowly, it raised a branching, writhing appendage towards the drone. That was when we lost the feed.
The wind outside was fierce. The facility we were staying in was situated on a continental plain, not far from a cluster of inland mountains, where the wind swept down the slopes and sped up, unimpeded, to hundreds of miles per hour. It never snowed in Antarctica, but that didn't stop hurricane winds from snatching up tiny particles of ice and whipping them at you with terrifying speed. The effect was a whiteout, a gray, somber void on the other side of every window that left nothing visible. No sky, no sun, not even the icy floor beneath the main building's elevated foundations.
"It's almost too much," Kim said after a while. "If we just found a jellyfish, it would be a lot, but people would believe us. But this, it's like something out of a bad movie. How am I supposed to get up at a conference and show people this footage?"
Kim, Alex, and I were seated in the canteen. All the other scientists had wandered off to their own rooms to begin the lifetime's task of going through every reading we had. Every pulse of sonar, every bit of infrared, every minute fluctuation in temperature and pressure. It had to be understood, cataloged, made sense of. In a way, it was probably a comfort to them, hiding from the madness by fixating on the minutiae.
"You know what I think?" Kim said. "Forget any results. I want to leave. Let someone else get the glory."
"Even if we wanted to," Alex said, "the storm prohibits flying for at least another week."
"Just so long as I can be the first one out," she replied.
"Maybe when the storm's clear, we can discuss people leaving," I said.
"But for now, we've got enough data to last us a lifetime and enough equipment to analyze..."
"Sir?"
A young man burst into the room. I immediately recognized him as belonging to the security detachment that had flown in with me. So far, the five or six armed men had kept separate from the scientists, and if it wasn't for his sudden reappearance, I could have easily forgotten that there was anyone staying in the facility who wasn't a researcher. It must have been an incredibly boring job, at least under normal circumstances. The man who stood before me didn't look bored, though. He looked worried and out of his depth. Alex was clearly the sir he'd been referring to, and the older man immediately stood up and addressed him.
"What's going on?" he asked.
"There's been a breach, sir," he said. "Something has entered the chamber."
"How do you possibly know that?"
Alex cried.
"We can hear it, sir."
We entered the ground building to find that we had two immediate problems. The first was that the pressurized chamber was under intense stress. Internal readings indicated that water had flooded the room and was exerting an incredible force against the reinforced walls. So far, they were holding, but the pressure was steadily increasing, and we knew that sooner or later, something would give. The second problem was the sound that emanated from within.
Thunk, thunk, thunk.
I flinched each time it rang out, physically recoiling from the bulkhead with fear. I tried to hide it from the others, but looking around, I realized it wasn't necessary. Alex, Kim, and the security guard were all equally terrified. Something was inside that room. Something that had come up from the lake below and was patiently beating a tattoo against the walls with unsettling regularity. "I'm here," the sound seemed to say. "I'm here, and I want to meet you."
"We need to release the pressure," Alex said. His voice was shaky, his skin pale.
We need to...
"I'm not opening that door,"
Kim snapped. I looked at the pressure readings and grimaced.
"It's not giving us a choice," I said. "If that structure fails, it'll be worse than a bomb going off."
"All the more reason to not open it,"
Kim cried.
"Think about what you just said. It's not giving us a choice. Do you want to play that game?"
"We don't know what it wants," Alex replied. "We don't know what it is. Maybe,
Maybe what? She said. Maybe it's here to play chess? To be our friend? Is that seriously what we're proposing?
If that chamber blows, I said, we get answers to those questions whether we like it or not. We can retreat to safety, sure, but it doesn't make any of our problems go away. Besides, it doesn't have to be the door we open. There are specialized valves to release pressure, and we can use those to keep it from blowing.
Thunk. Thunk. Thunk.
If Kim had any counter-arguments, they were forgotten. The walls of the chamber had shaken, and something, some screw or bolt, had flung out and struck the ceiling and punched a hole right through. Alex, I said, help me get the pressure valves open.
This is insane!
Kim cried as I walked over to the nearest valve.
Thunk. Thunk.
The knocking stopped just as my hand gripped the wheel. A look at Alex showed he was sweating despite the cold. He hesitated to come any closer, lurking a few feet away from me and the chamber.
I need help, I told him.
Okay, he said, nodding so absent-mindedly that I wondered if he was in some kind of shock.
Come on,
I cried, while pointing to the opposite side of the wheel. Alex was startled by my shout, but he finally started to walk across the vent and toward me.
Alex, we don't need to do...
Kim started to say, before she was suddenly cut off.
Thunk!
The final hammer blow was louder than any other we'd heard. It was like a peal of thunder went off right next to my ear, an explosive punch delivered with perfect timing and, I soon realized, in a very precise location. The valve broke open just as Alex had passed the opening. Water gushed out with tremendous force, enough to knock him back. Internal mechanisms were designed to control the flow, and they stopped the blow from being lethal, but it was still a brutal strike, and he was sent skittering across the floor while the water spewed out in a furious torrent. I could see him under the black brine, struggling desperately, and I thanked God he was alive. I immediately ran over to drag Alex away from the bubbling water, even as my mind raced with the terrifying realization that whatever had attacked the chamber had done so with impossible insight. On some level, I knew it must be scrutinizing us, and it took every ounce of courage just to stay in the room. Alex struggled as I took hold of one of his legs and tried to pull him out from under the water. I paid it little attention and dragged him clear of the flow, intent on helping him. But the sight of a glistening black tentacle wrapped around his head made me recoil and cry out. I fell on my ass and heard a chorus of disgusted and horrified cries as Kim and some new arrivals took register of the strange growth that enveloped the man's head. It was a repulsive cluster of alien muscle attached to a glistening black tendril trailing back through the open valve.
Get it off!
I shouted to no one in particular, hoping to God that someone would have an idea of what to do. Alex's struggles were already growing faint.
Thunk. Thunk. Thunk.
Before any of us could take another breath, there was the briefest sound of tightening fibers before the tendril whipped back into the chamber. It passed effortlessly through the 6-inch-wide opening and did not slow or even show signs of a struggle. Not even when, with a sound like silk tearing, it took most of Alex with it. I had made the decision to withdraw from the study and the site at large. Kim was clearly relieved, and so was I. Whatever excitement we felt over the find was diminished by the memory of having to clean up Alex's remains. I knew I would never forget having to lift the body bag, only to realize it barely weighed more than 40 pounds. We had found something nightmarish down in that lake, and the small encounters we'd already survived were more than enough to keep me sleepless for years to come. Unfortunately, the storm was still raging outside, and we had no hope of evacuation by air for at least another 3 days. Kim and I were kept busy packing up our equipment, but Kim's specialty was data analysis and not engineering, so there were times when the work fell entirely on me. It was on the second night that I told her to head to bed early while I finished up the last 30 minutes or so of work. But only a few minutes after she left,
I found myself staring at the chamber that dominated the room like a strange obelisk. The image of that thing glaring at us through the screen returned to me, and with a shiver, I decided I would finish packing the rest in the morning. Staying alone in that place for even a moment or two was a stupid thing to do.
Stephen. The sound was an electric whisper that made my limbs weak and my hands falter.
Equipment hit the ground with a clatter I barely heard.
All my attention was on one of the speakers near a station on the back wall. It belonged to one of the geologists who had lowered microphones down on the original dive and was using them to record an audio profile of the lake below. With everything going on, it had escaped all of our notice. But as I stared at the glowing green monitor, it dawned on me that the microphone was probably the last remaining piece of equipment still in the water. So why had I just heard Alex speak my name into it? I told myself I'd been mistaken, even as I decided I would sprint the whole way back to my room.
Stephen, the voice said before I could take a single step.
Stephen, it's cold down here.
This isn't real, I muttered.
I know what the temple was built for.
Alex's voice was the wet gurgle of a pneumonia patient in their last days. It made me think of someone drowning in mucus, of a desperate soul consumed by pain and despair.
Stephen,
he wailed.
It won't let me die.
His words hit me like a sledgehammer. For a second, I thought there was nothing in the entire world that could frighten me more. And it was then that the door to the pressure chamber swung open. I found myself rooted to the spot, my mind reeling with mounting terror as it processed the impossible. An enormous titanium bulkhead, otherwise inoperable by anything except powerful hydraulics, had glided open like a creaking mansion door. Black water immediately bubbled forth and filled the air with roiling steam and a cloying stench unlike anything else I had ever smelled. It was awful. A foul mixture of rotting flesh, ammonia, and a musty scent that really was unrivaled. Some kind of flotsam came with, pale strips of strange-looking plants and unrecognizable biological matter. The room I was in was large, but by the time I managed to look down and realize that my shoes were already wet, time was running out. I turned and ran, desperate to outpace the water that was already surging past my feet and flowing towards the door, threatening to trip me. All around me, equipment started to topple. Desks were dragged along the floor with an ear-cringing squeal, while computers short-circuited and fell over. Under other circumstances, I would have been in tears from the loss of data and expensive one-of-a-kind technology, but I was ready to sacrifice anything if it meant getting out of there sooner. I pushed ahead, increasingly aware that the water was fast on its way to flooding the entire space and showed no signs of slowing. Pretty soon, I'd be wading through the stuff at knee height. The thought had me picking up my pace, but I managed to get only halfway to the door before the lights cut out. Immediately, my foot hit something unseen, something that moved. I was sent sprawling forwards, completely blind and fumbling in the dark. Despite the water, I hit the concrete hard and my wrist rolled, plunging me face first into the ever-rising torrent. The feel of it enclosing my head made my heart pound with hysterical panic, and for a second, I wondered if I might already be dead and trapped in my worst nightmare. Eventually, the panic passed, and using my good hand, I got some purchase on the floor and pushed myself up with a desperate gasp. With perfect timing, the emergency lights finally kicked in, and the room was suffused in the dim, pale glow of rarely used fluorescence. I'd been thrown halfway across the room and was farther from the door than ever, but the water had stopped rising and was eerily still. All the different workstations had been shifted to new locations by the current, but were now at rest, bits of equipment strewn haplessly across their surfaces or missing somewhere in the water below. Once I was standing, the only sound was the occasional slosh of water, and an all-pervading drip, drip, drip. Quietly, terrified that the movement would attract attention, I lifted one leg and took a step backward. Nothing changed above the surface, but for all I knew, a dozen unseen shapes were converging on my position, and I had no way to stop them or even know how long I had to live. The only thing I could do was stick to the plan and keep moving one foot at a time. I managed another three steps when one of the desks slid a few inches across the floor. It was a gut-wrenching reminder that something was active beneath the water. It didn't help that all manner of things floated around, ranging from office furniture to unrecognizable clumps of rotting albino plants. Sometimes something would slither past my leg, touching my bare ankles, and I had no way of knowing if it was a living thing or just some dead piece of flotsam drifting aimlessly beneath the surface. When the door opened behind me, it was a sudden reminder that a world existed beyond that room. It had barely been 10 minutes since I'd heard Alex speak, but I'd spent that time so terrified that my perception had narrowed until I could only think of things that mattered to my direct survival. I had completely forgotten that the power outage would have alerted others. I was so fixed on whatever shared that water with me that I didn't even turn to greet my rescuers or respond to their cries. Nothing but survival could find purchase in my adrenaline-addled mind. It wasn't until I heard feet splashing past me and saw several men stomping past, guns raised, that I looked up and saw Kim reaching out to touch my shoulder. "What happened?" she asked. "Did you open the bulkhead?" I must have been pale as a ghost, because when I looked at her, she froze up a little, like my fear was contagious. "Shut it down," I hissed between clenched teeth, even as I lifted one leg to continue my painstaking backward walk. "Explosives, grenades, anything, shut it down." "It'll freeze on its own anyway," she replied. "The heating rods have turned off. That's probably why it hasn't already flooded this whole room up to the ceiling." "Why did you open the door?" she repeated. "I didn't open shit," I whispered. "Kim, we aren't alone in here." "What?" He said, "You aren't alone up there." Kim's eyes went as wide as dinner plates at the sound of Alex's voice coming from the speakers. "Fuck this," I cried, while grabbing her hand and turning to run the last few meters back to the door. As I turned away, one of the men inside the room cried out and went down, but I didn't turn to look back, not even when gunfire rang out and ricochets pinged the wall nearest my head. Instead, I forced my leaden feet through the grimy water, Kim in tow, and did my best to ignore the screams. When we reached the door, I threw us both out onto the metal walkway beyond and went to slam the door shut, but was left struggling against the water that continuously poured out. "Help!" I cried, reaching out to help Kim from where she had fallen. "What about the men inside?" She looked inside at the same time she asked her question. By now, the gunfire had stopped, but there was still the sound of struggling feet and crying men along with crashing furniture. With a whip-crack sound, one of the men let out a terrible scream, and Kim jerked back from the doorway, her face covered in blood. "Shut the fucking door!" she screamed suddenly. Whatever she'd seen had clearly changed her mind, and I was glad I'd missed it. I was only grateful that she joined me in pushing it shut. "Are you sure it's all done in there?" I asked. "The water's all frozen." Kim nodded as we stood by the door to the ground facility. It had been 2 days, and we had stayed in the base a few hundred meters away, refusing to answer any of the other scientists' questions and threatening hell on anyone who dared go look for themselves. It certainly hadn't earned us any friends, but we didn't care. Our evac was just an hour out, and we were all too ready to leave that godforsaken continent. But there was still one last job to do. Using a crowbar, I wrenched the door out of its frame. Kim made a passing comment that whatever lived down there could have easily gotten out if it wanted to, but I just ignored it. I had no way of knowing what that thing could or couldn't do, and for once, Ignorance was enough for me. Whatever its motivation or choices, it had been content with taking the men we'd left behind and no one else. To my shame, I only felt relief about this.
Steven,
I'm so cold.
My mind's falling apart. I can feel bits of myself sloughing away.
What are you? I can't see you. Where am I? What was that?
Something's coming.
Jesus fucking Christ, why won't I die?
Kim faltered at the sound of their voices. She looked at me with terror, and I knew she'd seen the same thing written on my face.
You were right, she said. They're still...
I nodded. I could hear them when I came out to check the door on the first night.
I don't... How are they? Are they down there?
She cried. I don't know, I shook my head. But there'll be a team here soon. They'll find the tunnel frozen over, the facility destroyed, our data centers ruined. But this... I gestured to the room and the voices within.
This will demand further investigation, she said. How can we get them to stop? Do you have a plan to help them?
To get inside the room, I had to step up onto a solid foot of ice that had frozen. Emergency lighting had failed entirely by now, but there was enough daylight to make the gloomy space beyond visible.
Their heads,
Kim stuttered as she looked at the array of corpses.
They're all gone. How are they?
I don't understand either, I said, as I carefully shuffled over to the farthest workstation. It was there that the voices cried out from an overturned speaker. But we can't help them. I hesitated for a moment as I took out the wire cutters and found the cord leading to the ruined pressure chamber. Even now, the men hadn't stopped baying like a discordant mob of hellbound souls. There were pleas for help and insults born of desperation. I wondered for a second if there really was something we could do, but that would involve drilling down to the lake and beginning this nightmare anew. This wasn't some errant animal we were dealing with. It was intelligent and cruel and older than we could possibly imagine. Even worse, it could toy with dead men and keep them alive to prolong their suffering. There was a forgotten god down there, and it needed to stay forgotten. I cut the wire, and the voices stopped immediately.
But they're still down there, Kim said, her voice an injured whisper.
With deliberate slowness, the wire was pulled from my hand and back into the chamber before disappearing through a pinprick hole in the ice. And so is something else, I said. Let's keep it that way. That was The Temple in the Lake by Christian Wallace. Christian Wallace is a PhD student and writer hailing from rain-soaked Wales, where he grew up comforted by ancient castles, crumbling coastlines, and the old things that live in the woods. You can find more of his stories at chwallace.co.uk and at Velux Books. And that, dear friends, finishes up our episode. If you enjoyed The Temple in the Lake, I might also recommend two other stories for you. Who Goes There by John W. Campbell, which was the basis for the movie The Thing, and The Temple by H.P. Lovecraft. Seriously, folks, with tentacle monsters and an underground structure built for ancient gods, you had to have guessed that I would mention good old Lovecraft. I'd like to thank P.D. Williams and Christian Wallace for tonight's stories, and I encourage you to go check out more of their work. Also, thanks to you, listeners, for joining me again on Horror Hill. As always, I'll be back with more next week. So until that time, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley.
Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. Note that any writing utilizing artificial intelligence is ineligible. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media, and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. That's ericpeabodyvoice, and we can talk details. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.